Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching WandaVision. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us for the first time, this is a multi-tier podcast project that we are doing around the Disney Plus Marvel show WandaVision, which just had a big episode this week, a big moment at the end of it. We're going to talk about all of that. First, I'm going to talk to Richard about it and see what he thinks is going on. And then I might get about 9 levels down nerdy with Anthony Breskin, our colleague, for our final section of the podcast, where we get really into the comic book weeds and what it all means. And in the middle of all of that, right smack dab in the middle, we have a lovely interview with Kat Dennings, who plays Darcy Lewis, Dr. Darcy Lewis. So that is what we have in store for you today. We've got some emails. We've got some theories. It's a pretty exciting time to be covering the show. Richard, I know that folks, if they want to, they can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Do you have any emails this week that we can discuss?
Yeah, the emails are rolling in, so thank you all for sending them. The first one I wanted to call out was from Melissa, who says, I was thinking a bit about the limitations of Wanda's powers and if she can, in fact, create people from, quote, nothing. From what we learned in episode 4 about most of the townspeople being played by real Westview residents, it would appear that Wanda isn't creating people or the town from scratch. We now know that to be true. That's Richard speaking. Back to Melissa. She's projecting a reality on top of them. The same is true of Westview. She didn't dream it up in the middle of an empty field. She's layered over an existing real town with her fantasy. I think we've seen her create objects before, though, so that might poke a hole in my theory. So, what are the twins being projected onto? If they're not being dreamed up from whole cloth by Wanda, that is, I think the timing of the show might come into play here. If we're 3 weeks out from the return of the snap, maybe Wanda found out that she was pregnant after Vision died, so she could be actually pregnant with twins in real life, but she's accelerating their aging and birth in Westview reality. And what if finding out she was pregnant was the inciting incident for her taking over Westview and creating a fantasy there? She's not just mourning Vision's death, she's mourning a life they could have had together as a family. And that might also explain the sitcom setting. She's putting herself into idyllic family scenarios that she and Vision and the twins can experience together. I think that a lot of that email kind of bears out in this episode, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, this idea that, like, she didn't create Monica's clothing from nothing. They, like, came from her Kevlar vest and stuff like that. This idea of her repurposing matter. Mm-hmm. And ditto, like, with Vision, that she's definitely working off the body parts that she stole from a lab. But I don't know. I feel like the twins might be an exception. You'll notice that her magic doesn't work on them. So, and historically in the comics, like, she does create those twins out of something, but it's not quite the same as, like, reanimating Vision's body or something like that. I also don't know how she would be pregnant from Vision in the first place, given that he's an android. But I don't know the answer to that. Stranger things have happened in the MCU, but I like the email a lot.
Yes.
And there definitely is something that sort of kicked Wanda off here. What do you think, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I it's hard for me to sort of think about the kids, because if they're sort of created in this Westview alternate reality, like, does that mean that they don't exist when this ends? I don't know, but I know comic book rules kind of allow for a lot. Certainly Vision was kind of created and existed for a while. So, like, why not these kids, no matter where they're from? But I do think that, like, I should add that Melissa did, say something that I think that we had echoed, you and I had said, earlier about, she says, an aside, I don't know if I love that Wanda's identity and actions are so tied into motherhood, especially after the Black Widow sterilization stuff, but we'll see.
Right.
And I think that, yeah, that, you know, if we're kind of locating all of Wanda's motivation in this series as, like, a kind of a, you know, I just wanted my little white picket fence family life thing, it might be a little bit reductive of of a person's complicated you know, emotions and intellectual life. But I could see the child thing being in concert with her grief over Vision as being enough of a reason to create a fictional family unit.
Yeah, absolutely. What else?
All right. We have an email from Tracy. Firstly, thanks so much for your amazing work. My 12-year-old son and I regularly listen to your various podcasts and always watch any series or movie that you recommend, knowing it will be worth our time. 12-year-old watching We Are Who We Are. I'm good. Progressive. and listening to your podcast has helped me through some tough times over the past month. So please just know how much I appreciate what you do. Thank you, Tracy. That's very nice. She goes on to say, just a little thought on the latest WandaVision episode with regard to the fact that Dottie is not shown at all on the FBI wall of missing persons. Oh. I was talking this over with my son, and we were trying to come up with theories. I said, well, who else isn't on the wall? He says, well, Monica isn't there. I said, that's because the FBI already know who she is because she's one of them. And he said to me, well, maybe they already know who Dottie is because she's one of them. It also seems interesting to me that it was Dottie's blood that turned red when the radio message infiltrated Wanda's illusion. At first, I just thought the color seeped in because the radio call was an outside-the-bubble creation that interrupted the illusion, in the same way the drone was in color because it was an outside-the-bubble creation that interrupted the illusion. But is it significant that it was Dottie's blood that became colored rather than the radio? Could she be from the outside-the-bubble and be known to the FBI, and that's why she's not on the wall? Just a thought. Would love to know what you think. With love from Australia, Tracy and Dexter. Thank you, Tracy and Dexter.
Oh,
thanks for listening.
Yay. I love that.
I also love that they're centering Emma Caulfield as, like, potentially, like, a big deal in the episodes to come.
Same.
And I think we've talked about this. I don't think that character is there kind of as a throwaway accident. Like, I would have to imagine that there is more to come from her.
Yeah, I've talked a little bit about this with Anthony, but I'm so excited to talk to you about it because we share an Emma Caulfield love. I don't know the answer. I thought it was odd that Dottie wasn't on the board last week, and then she wasn't on the board again this week because some folks were like, oh, maybe they hadn't gotten to her yet, or maybe they hadn't, you know, observed her yet. But I was sort of squinting at the board this week, and she's still not up there. I find that very suspicious because Agnes is up there and doesn't have a driver's license, and that's suspicious in and of itself.
Yeah.
But Dottie not being up there at all has me, like, really looking. I have this pet theory. Maybe she is from the outside world. I that is certainly a possibility. I don't know who she is. I have a pet theory based entirely on hair color. Do you want to hear?
Please. This is the place for pet theories about hair color.
All right. So she's blonde. Agnes has dark hair and Wanda has red hair. And especially in this episode, episode 5 that we just watched, two of those ladies are rocking like some serious perms. And that made me think of The Witches of Eastwick, which has Susan Sarandon as a redhead, Michelle Pfeiffer as a blonde, and Cher as a raven-haired beauty, and a lot of perms to go around. And I was like, Witches of Eastwick, Witches of Westview. Like, I feel like Dottie is, if not actually a witch, just like a third in a triad of powerful women. That's my like personal pet theory.
I like
about
that.
What's going on?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of kind of cultural precedent for that kind of arrangement. Yeah.
We're talking about the power of three.
Well, Cheryl Blossom, Betty, and Veronica. You know,
like, sure. Yes. Yes. Icons.
I'm not gonna stop talking about Archie on this. but yeah, I mean, I think any possibility is fun, as you know, if we get more of Dottie, and I, you know, maybe she and Agnes are, it's Agnes, right? Not Agatha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they're like they're super villains. I mean, you know, Wanda does say in this episode, you really think it's meme doing all of this?
Right.
So clearly it's not. So yeah, I hope that, Tracy and Dexter are onto something.
And something that I thought was interesting, Emma Caulfield gave an interview where she said, you know, she's worked with Jack Schaefer, who's a showrunner before, on this independent film Timer. And something that, she, you know, so it's like Jack called Emma up and was like, hey, Emma, you want to work? You know what I mean? Like that happens all the time in Hollywood. But what Emma said is that Jack needed the sign off from Kevin Feige to cast Emma. Now, it might be that Kevin Feige is personally overseeing every single role being cast in every single Marvel TV show, but what might also be true is that she's playing a big enough character that it needed a sign-off from the top brass, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And also the way that she's been used in the show, I think, is so interesting because, like, she's not in every episode. She is a really memorable part of episode 2. And like Agnes says all this stuff about her, about how she's like the key to everything. She's like, you know, she's talking about her as like queen of the social circle, right? But she's like, she's the key to the whole town, and like her flowers bloom upon penalty of death, and like all this like weird stuff. And then she just kind of goes away. But we haven't forgotten about her because she makes such a memorable impression. But it's like the perfect kind of, like, if this were like an Agatha Christie novel, it's the perfect person to come back and be the murderer, because they're not in every scene reminding us of them, like,
right,
who they are, yeah, but they're memorable enough for us that we won't be like, well, that came out of nowhere, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm a coffee.
Especially because, like, Agnes really seems to, if she's the one kind of describing Dottie that way, like, Agnes in this episode, like, is, you know, oh, should I take that again? Like, she's very much, like, yeah, hyper conscious of this, you know, illusion. And whether she's kind of playing subservient because she's actually pulling the strings, right, who knows? But, yeah, I think we've got more to come from both those characters, which is exciting.
Very exciting. All right. I want to go back to something that you actually brought. I think you might have cracked something wide open last week, Richard. Are you ready?
Oh, please. Yeah.
I'm so excited to talk to you about this. So last week, you know, you told me that you've been doing some Googling about Wanda's sons and their sexual orientation and all that sort of thing. And we talked about like the possibility of like maybe there's like – we've been long waiting for, I say we, fans have been waiting for the MCU to get like ever more with the times in terms of like what kind of stories they center. And so this idea that like perhaps with two queer sons, a gay storyline or a gay romance might be integral. I mean, we only have a few episodes left of the season. We might just be kicking something off for the future, but might be something that we see in WandaVision. And you and I had talked about this character, this actor, Isaiah Knott, who plays, who's credited only as the boy next door. And you, being like the wonderful Richard Lawson that you are, went immediately to that young man's Instagram to like see what was what. And you noted that there was like a post from him there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where like there was like a promo still and him in his WandaVision sweatshirt. I tweeted about that and I linked to it. And then that guy deleted it.
I hope we didn't get anyone in trouble.
I really hope we didn't get him in trouble. Well, then he reposted it, but he reposted it without that publicity still of him like behind the picket fence, Like, that's gone, but the rest of it came back. So I definitely hope we didn't get anyone in trouble, but it makes me think like that you're super onto something, Richard. That's, you know, that to me feels like he might be more than just like a boy next door cameo. I mean, especially if he has his own publicity still. So the primary suspect for who we might be playing is this character Hulkling, who is a love interest, for one of Wanda's boys. So, you know, that's, and as we see on this episode, the boys are growing very fast. So,
yeah. And if they're doing sitcom tropes, teenagers are absolutely a major component of family sitcom tropes, you know.
Exactly.
You have, obviously, you know, you have Nikki and Alex on Full House because Michelle got too old. So then you have like the middle kid, and then you have the teen, you know, it's very programmatic. Right. They seem to be working their way through everything else. So why not, you know, annoying girl crazy teens or boy crazy teens?
And the other thing I want to say is that I wish I had the full quote in front of me. I don't, but in a very recent call, oh, there we go. Kevin Feige said, "A Southeast Asian superhero is coming to Disney Plus sooner than you think," on a recent call, which makes me think, like, Isaiah Knott, who I have not investigated exactly, you know, is looks like he might be like Filipino, something like that. So I don't want to presume, but like that could be part of the dots we're putting together here. So. So I like that. And I love that, like, Richard, in just being yourself, may have stumbled onto something very big here. So that makes me
really
happy.
Look at that. I'm good at this, it turns out.
You are. All right. So let's talk about the big thing that happens at the end of this episode. And I want Richard, what your thoughts or understandings are about, a certain person showing up at the very end of this episode.
Yeah. So what happened was, I was with, you know, the other three people in my coven, and we were calling the corners, and we had been missing Evan Peters. You know, we hadn't seen him in something in a while. And so we basically conjured him up, I think. So hope everyone's happy. No, it's Evan Peters. It's Quicksilver from Days of Future Past, from the X-Men universe. Which was always a kind of funny thing where when X-Men was siloed over at Fox and, you know, Disney had the rest of Marvel, that there would be two actors playing Quicksilver at the same time. And so now they have found, now that they're all under the same cozy corporate umbrella, they have found a way to kind of ironically comment on that in much in the same way I'm told that the next Spider-Man movie will incorporate potentially Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire in some sort of multiverse situation. So I thought that was a clever way to do something we had talked about a few weeks ago about this rumor or thought that eventually they were going to have to bring mutant mythology into the world of Avengers because they're all linked under the same Marvel umbrella. So, or whatever, corporate property. And this is a kind of funny meta way to do it. And, I was surprised, and I'm really curious to see if this is just a kind of one-off little joke thing, or if there's actually going to be something more deeply, like, you know, textual about it.
Yeah, this is a bit of casting that actually leaked out like a long time ago, but was never formally announced. And so there was a question, like, there was a very strong rumor that Evan Peters was in WandaVision in some capacity, and we're still unsure exactly how big this part may be.
You were reading my Evan Peters news update Twitter feed?
I was AmericanHunkStory.com. Like, we knew that he was going to be in the show, just not who he was playing necessarily. And like, of course, a lot of people were like, maybe he's playing Quicksilver, maybe there will be two Quicksilvers. You know, Quicksilver, Aaron Taylor Johnson's version of Quicksilver died in Age of Ultron, but like, Vision died. So what, you know, what's up, what's down, what's real? It doesn't matter. So like, maybe we'll have both, maybe we'll have him instead, and that'll just be like a little winking joke, or maybe it's something bigger and more serious about, you know, bringing in all these other characters. And I think when you think about the way that Kevin Feige has talked about, he's talked about this storyline that's going to kick off in WandaVision, is going to go through Spider-Man and into the new Doctor Strange movie, which is called The Multiverse of Madness.
And that
it's this idea that, like, yeah.
Wanda is in that movie, right? That's already been kind of announced that, like, Elizabeth Olsen is, like, a major cast member.
Yes. That she's got a major role in that movie. And then I think Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays Doctor Strange, is going to be in the Spider-Man movie. So it's like it's a trilogy of sorts, this multiverse trilogy, perhaps. And that this might be, speaking of inciting incidents, this might be the inciting incident. That somehow Wanda or maybe one of the other powerful people who might be involved in the story have plucked a character from a different universe and put them down here in Westview. And that that might be a crack that just widens as everything goes forward.
Intriguing.
Is that interesting? Okay.
Yeah, like, no, I don't know how much I'm in the minority here, but I really, really love Days of Future Past. I mean, I know that the person who directed it is not a good person, but, like, I think that movie is really, like, interesting, and I like time travel stuff that kind of deals with, like, the tragedy of time travel, and I think it's a really great movie, and that's kind of heavy and serious, but then there's this wonderful interlude with Evan Peters' character that's this kind of slow-mo thing where he's moving fast, but we see him slow, you know, and so it's fun to sort of see him brought back. I mean, he's been in other subsequent X-Men movies, but, like, I don't know. I think it's cool and could potentially, you know, that it's paving the way to introduce X-Men, which is the kind of the superhero stuff that I somewhat, you know, paid attention to when I was a kid, is promising.
Something that Feige said in his interview with us was this idea that, like, when they go to cast things, like when they decide put together Infinity War, Endgame, they had a literal wall with, like, trading cards of all the characters that they had introduced and they had in their disposal, big and small, right? And that they did something kind of similar when casting WandaVision. They were like, well, and that's how they, like, plucked Randall Park from Ant-Man and Darcy Lewis from Thor, is, like, that's how they're populating their world now. They've seeded so many things all over the place that they could do that. But I think what, you know, definitely what he didn't say then, but what could potentially be true, is that this board may be way bigger than we're thinking, and that on that board are all the characters and actors that Feige thinks worked well in the Fox world, in the Sony world, and in the Netflix world, because there's rumors that Charlie Cox's Daredevil might be showing up in something. So, like, what I think is true is that Feige, in his infinite wisdom, is trying to create a storyline starting perhaps today, where in his guise as, you know, benevolent overlord of this massive corporation of intellectual properties now, he's not going to disavow these things that came before, but rather embrace them in a fun meta way, multiverse way, and make them part of the ongoing story he's telling.
Yeah, might as well. You can do whatever, you know, they can do whatever they want, you know, which is maybe fearsome in a sort of cultural way, but, like,
yeah.
But yeah, they invent the rules, they own the rules, like, why not, you know, if I think they have proven pretty consistently over the years that, like, they find a clever way, you know, and I think this is the beginning of that. I think it's a clever reveal, that, I mean, I don't know, do you think people really needed to be, like, familiar with the other Quicksilver to really have this moment land, or do you think it would have landed no matter what? I don't know.
I mean, I definitely know some people who this is their first Marvel thing they're ever watching.
Uh-huh.
And in that way, they're not going to know,
right,
that this is a different Pietro, because even when they were showing us, like, archive footage of Wanda, like, in protests in Sokovia and stuff like that, Aaron Taylor Johnson was cut out of the frame. So we haven't seen him in this show. So, you know, it is going to require them to turn to their Marvel educated friend and be like, why is everyone freaking out about this guy here?
Because Wanda, it's not, she recognizes that it's not the Pietro that she knows, right?
Totally. Yeah. That's what it seems like. Yeah. She knows something's wrong, but she's also, like, it's part of the, like, it's a lot of complicated things at once, because she seems to know something's wrong, but also she's so willing to be embraced by a comforting fiction throughout this that I think, you know, she's going to like go with it. For how long she goes with it, I don't know. Yeah. But it seems like maybe she might go with it. So, but yeah, I mean, just this idea, I just think it's, you know, Tom Holland has been doing all this promo for his film Cherry. And, you know, people who like to know what's happening in Marvel like to pay close attention to Tom Holland interviews because he tends to like loose lips, sink ships, say things about things. Yeah. He hasn't really said that. He's been well media trained since perhaps, but he's been saying stuff about – he's been saying the usual sort of boilerplate hype stuff about the Spider-Man movie in terms of like, this is the biggest, most epic movie ever. You know, and usually I just sort of like roll my eyes and move on because that's what everyone says about every movie. But to a certain degree, I don't think it's ever been attempted for someone to come in and like unify – multiple franchises in that way. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. the Terminator sort of like franchise, like, kind of shakes the Etch-a-Sketch almost every time that they like start a new movie or whatever. And like, the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man certainly didn't acknowledge the Tobey Maguire. Like, they just pretended that didn't happen.
They did the origin story over again.
Exactly. And so this one is like, we're not going to do that. And the success of Into the Spider-Verse, the Sony animated film from a couple years ago, really primed the pump for audiences to understand what a multiverse is and how you might have different versions of the same character together in one space.
Well, to be fair, Joanna, the show Sliders already had done that thoroughly.
Many a Golden Gate Bridge existed in Sliders. But yeah, so so this is like potentially an enormous moment. And I love that it's happening in this weird Disney Plus show. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That like some people wrote off as this like funky little aberration when perhaps it is like the, to once again borrow Melissa's phrase, the inciting incident for a big story, the rest of how we're going to understand Marvel storytelling from now.
Yeah, know? I mean, it's kind of it's quite a thing to behold. And there is, yes, something kind of insidious about it, but there's also something really impressive just about how good they are at synergy. You know, mm-hmm. they are just good at folding all these pieces in together and making them unified, you know, and doing it in a way that's narratively engaging, but also, you know, does a fair amount of fan service, you know, because they have to tend to that core audience. And it's a balancing act that, you know, they keep pulling off. So
there you go. So that's like the big, obviously it comes right at the end, but it's the big moment of this episode. It's a reference Paul Bettany had said before the season started, I think, that this was going to be their Family Ties episode and that it was going to be sort of like a direct reference to the Tom Hanks Drunk Up Uncle episode, which is why like a few people were like, is this where Evan Peters shows up as the uncle? If they're referencing the Tom Hanks Uncle episode of Family Ties. Mm-hmm. It turns out Agnes got to play like the drunk aunt a little bit more than Evan Peters got to play the drunk uncle, but he's still here. Is there anything else you want to say about this sort of like Family Ties of it all, or the balance of like the external S.W.O.R.D. investigation and then the internal sort of bubble storyline?
Yeah, I have a couple things to say. Well, the first thing about the Family Ties of it all, to me, it felt a little bit more like Full House step by step y. Because like Family Ties, I remember being sort of like smart sitcom, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas true. This was a little dopier. But they definitely, like, the theme song they got right, you know? And I was thinking about it. I was like, why did so many of those sitcoms in the 80s have these, like, kind of wistful, serious songs to introduce, like, a goofy multicam sitcom? It's just a very, very funny, weird trope that just completely disappeared. So I was happy.
Also, the family portrait as the centerpiece.
Well, that's classic Family Ties. Yes.
Yeah.
And
but I was just thinking like Growing Pains had it. Like I feel like a bunch of shows at that time had like a family portrait that we kept revisiting.
And then Modern Family kind of tweaked it, you know, in their own way.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was funny and well observed. But you know, the other thing you mentioned about the sort of outside the bubble storyline, like I thought it was interesting that Wanda, like, of her own volition, left the bubble, confronted the people, acknowledged, I know that what's happening behind me is not real, or is real to some extent, but please let, you know, leave me be, or whatever. and showed, you know, not much remorse at all for like controlling the minds of, you know, hundreds of people. Yeah, but to see her acknowledge that, and just say like, I'm aware of you and, all this. So she's not under the same delusion that other people are, but then she goes back and is, or maybe it's beforehand, but either way, she talks to Vision about like, I can't control all this, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm curious. It seems like they're setting it up for, she is being controlled and there is something sinister about that, but it's kind of a, maybe a devil's bargain compromise, because it means she gets to have this family that she otherwise would have been denied.
No, I think that's exactly right. This idea that like she's in charge in a limited capacity,
right?
And that there's someone else puppeting like everything as a whole.
And to that end, like, and maybe you and Anthony have gotten into this, like maybe, and maybe it was someone in email said this, I don't remember, but like maybe the really sinister thing is they're trying to harvest these children, you know, who would have powers, and it's kind of like an incubator, and you can't, you know, you can't raise the kitten without the mama cat, you know, for a few months at least or whatever.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Which is actually kind of very like, that's a kind of, I feel like a long sort of sci-fi trope of like the mother is this sort of, you know, incubating object that actually doesn't really matter to the evil, whatever.
Yeah, there's like a famous Doctor Who storyline where like Amy Pond is sort of in captivity just for the child she's pregnant with and stuff like that. Yeah, so it's which is creepy and can feel disempowering to women if to be like reduced to like a uterus and all this sort of stuff like that. But I like your mama cat sort of analogy much better. But this idea that Vision in this episode asks Wanda, among other things, like, why are there no other children in this town? Like, why are ours the only children in this town, right?
Yeah.
And also Agnes's interest in the boys is, like, creepy and something to watch, I think.
Yeah, like, she shows up at the doghouse and, like, she clearly is keeping a close eye on those kids.
She sprays them and then they're grown up a bit more.
Right.
And then...
like plants.
And then when the dog dies, and they look like they might sort of grow themselves and Wanda stops them, like, as a way to process their grief. Like, my galaxy brain is like, Agnes killed that dog in order to push the boys into growing more. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
that's all part of, like, I don't know what she needs them for or why, but it feels like she's invested in getting them to grow up as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
For whatever it is she needs.
Yeah.
You know?
And it does provoke the question of what would you do if you found Catherine Hahn rooting around in azalea bushes in your neighborhood?
With a dead dog.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I think about that often, honestly.
Well, you should. It's important.
The eternal question. All right. Anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it. I'm happy with how this is developing. I think it keeps me guessing, and I'm really enjoying, you know, the week to week. I'm glad this wasn't a thing that we could binge. You know, I think it makes it a little more special.
Same. So let us go to our conversation with Kat Dennings, and then Anthony and I will be back to talk about why Monica Rambeau's X-rays came back blank.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good.
This is for our podcast. And so some of the questions come from our listeners. Some of them come from our co-hosts. And some come from me. So
love it.
Let's go for it. So all the bad ones obviously did not come from me. So there we go. So the first question is from one of our listeners who wants to know when Darcy switched from political science to astrophysics and what inspired that switch for her.
Well, as someone who didn't go to college, I don't know when people do things like that. But what I imagine is that Jane Foster was the main inspiration for Darcy switching majors. And, you know, Dr. Eric Selvig also in her, you know, the last time we see Darcy is in Thor: The Dark World. So between Jane and Eric, I think Darcy made the decision to pursue academia in a different way. So now she's Dr. Darcy Lewis.
Other than the doctorate, what else, you know, sort of in your view has changed about Darcy since we last saw her?
Well, you know, I wanted to make sure she was the same person, but I really liked the idea of approaching it almost as a whole new role because so much has changed. And even though we haven't seen her, we can imagine so many things have gone down in her life. So it's been, I don't know, 8 years, something like that since last time. So she's grown up a lot and she's now an expert. She's now a grown-up. I just said that, but, you know, it's been a long day. But I don't know. I really enjoyed playing that. You know, you don't usually get to pay off a character as an actor.
That many years later, especially. Yeah, it's Darcy was always, it seemed to me, always like a pretty confident person. Sort of how else does that maturity manifest in this like new approach you're taking to the role?
Well, I remember being extremely confident when I was a younger person, right. You know how confident you are when you're 20 and then you become 34 and you're like, I don't know anything. I think that's part of growing up is realizing you don't know what you're talking about. So I've certainly infused her with a little bit of my own life experience. And my dad is actually a scientist. So there was a little bit of like personal pride in even just pretending to be one in a show.
When you get the call from Marvel to say, like, can you come back? Can you do Darcy again? Are you yes, all in no matter what the circumstance? Or did you want to know more about what the project was when you
I cared, of course, but it was yes immediately. When you get a call from Marvel, you just say yes. It doesn't matter what they want you to do. Pretty much there's nothing I wouldn't do for them. So yeah. I was thrilled. And then I found out it was this and I was almost confused because Darcy's never had any interaction with anyone in WandaVision at all. So it was a really unexpected place for her to go.
Is there, if she were to pop up in another sort of side Avengers story, is there another one that you've always sort of wanted to see her in?
Well, I remember reading a few fun like Tumblr posts about Darcy and Loki, and I think I kind of want to give those like three people what they want because I think that would be fun.
It only takes three to start internet rumor.
So true.
Yeah, it's true. And when you found out that that this was a show that's going to be like hopping through sitcom universes, was there a sitcom era that you were most excited to sort of like even be tangentially touching in all of this?
Well, I certainly didn't touch it, but the 50s sitcom part of the show for me, just as a fan of the 50s like aesthetic, you know, I was just so excited about that. You know, Elizabeth Olsen was incredible. She's incredible in everything, but I really loved watching her do all of that stuff. It's fun to see these actors kind of branching out because, you know, the Avengers stuff is very serious and you know, we all know what that was, watch the movies, but so it's very cool to see these actors doing something completely different. And Paul Bettany is one of the funniest people I've ever met. And he get, you know, you see it, you see a little bit of Paul finally like come through in these. So it's kind of joyful.
I loved those first few episodes where we're just like in the sitcom bubble entirely. But yeah. I know a lot of Marvel fans were excited to see in episode 4 something that felt a little bit more familiar to them as well. I'm curious for you, having worked on Marvel films and then this being Marvel television, from like almost a production value perspective, does it feel any different? It's the production value is so high on a show like this. Does it feel the same as working on a Marvel film?
Yeah, it does. But the way that you shoot a series is inherently different than how you shoot a movie, because there are just a few more moving parts in terms of like, oh, this location, you know, or this, or the weather, or this, you know, there's always something kind of shifting around. So with the films, I feel like, although I remember the first Thor movie, we had to keep pushing a major sequence because the mountains in the distance had snow on them some days and not on other days. So that's kind of a similar thing. But yeah, so there were a few more moving parts on this. And sometimes we would hop stages and do something, you know, and then go back and do something else. So, but as you said, the production value is incredibly high and just the highest standard of everything. So it's, as an actor, as someone who's used to being in a iPhone size trailer, like, you know, eating a marshmallow, it's a joy. It's wonderful. It's as good as it gets.
I was listening to that podcast interview you did with Whitney Cummings, I think last year, where you were talking about you got to set. There was a day when you had Darcy had to run through the field. You got to set, and there was no one listed under stunts, and you were like, "Oh, it's me. I'll be running."
Well, I didn't say it was this project.
Oh, okay, it was a different project.
Could have been something else.
Okay. But yeah, can we look forward to Action Darcy in this show?
I can't say, but I will say that you definitely see Darcy in situations that she's never been in before. There's a lot more. This is the first appearance. So there's so much more in the pipe. If that's the word.
Yeah. Coming down the pipe or coming down the pike. One of those. All right. A beautiful, fair, vague tease. I love that. Okay. So one thing about Darcy that fans have always, I think, loved about her is this idea of her as an audience proxy, right? Like she meets Thor, her reaction to Thor is probably what our reaction to Thor would be. You get to do this even more explicitly in this. You're literally the audience to this sort of sitcom that you're watching. Does that change the way you approach a character when you know that she's sort of doing that work for the audience?
No, only because she wouldn't know that. So there's almost there's the meta thing, and then there's like too much of it. So, you know, I still have to kind of be somewhat in the dark because she doesn't know just how much of an audience she's representing. So it's actually a key thing because I didn't exactly put that together until I watched it, because of course I knew what was going on, but I was approaching it as like, oh, she's investigating this strange anomaly. So she's now involved in watching it, but I didn't quite put that puzzle together because I'm not a real scientist, but it's definitely a really fun payoff to watch. And I was like, oh, that's what I'm doing. You know, now I'm us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really fun.
I love that. And I'm wondering, if you were to get to go inside the bubble, if Darcy got to do that, obviously we've already done the 50s. Is there a sitcom, and I know you've obviously worked on sitcoms, but is there a sitcom that you would love to see Darcy in inside the bubble?
Oh my God. It's an innocent enough question, but I feel like I can't answer it anyway.
Okay.
but I would like to.
One of my favorite, you know, I was sort of soliciting our listeners to see what they wanted to ask you. One of my favorite responses I heard from someone who had never watched any Marvel, is when they're watching this show, you know, they felt like they needed a lot of background, a lot of extra info on a lot of the other characters. But when your character showed up, they were like, I immediately like felt connected to this person. I knew who they were. It just like, it felt so comfortable. And I was just wondering sort of what you think. I mean, we've already talked about that sort of audience proxy aspect of Darcy, but what you think it is about her that audiences connect to so well.
Well, that's a really sweet, thing for them to say. I can only imagine it's because, you know, the beginning of the first three episodes of WandaVision, you're kind of thrust into a foreign land, right? You don't know what's going on. And that's really fun. We don't really get that nowadays because usually our TV is all there. You can just binge a show, you know, in a day or two or whatever. Right. If you're me, one day. you're forced to wait for answers. So I think when I show up, maybe it's my face, I don't know. But people feel like, you know, okay, she's here to solve the mystery, but I'm also coming in literally from the real world. So I think it was planned for this bus carrying a real person who's going to solve the mystery from the real world into this to kind of help guide the way initially. And also Jimmy Woo provides that a bit as well. And then once we team up, it's kind of a fun little partnership.
I wanted to ask you something that I asked Elizabeth Olsen when I talked to her, which was this story about Wanda. Obviously, in this episode 4 that we just all watched, we find out that like whatever's going on here, we don't know fully what's going on, but whatever's going on is tied to something going on with Wanda. And she's obviously in a lot of emotional distress. Mm-hmm. Some of the stories about Wanda in emotional distress in the comic books have, you know, written decades in the past, written often by men, have struck people as not the best handling of this idea of like a woman in distress. And I was talking to Elizabeth Olsen about how this show run by a woman, you know, staffed with all these great women, was interested in avoiding sort of this like hysterical female trope. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, that's a really good point. I'm not as familiar with Wanda's arc in the comics, like you're saying. I probably should have read more of them, but but you're right. Of course, you know, this is an age old issue, which is the male gaze on like, you know, what women feel and think, and they're always wrong. So yeah, we had an amazing art writer, Jack Schaefer, our executive producer, just wonderful genius and so involved in every step of it. And always cognizant of making sure that doesn't happen. You know, I really felt, even though, you know, I'm a scientist and I'm all this, I really felt like the whole Darcy was being considered, and she does it with Monica and with Wanda as well. And you know, a lot of the people that you see through the show, I mean, there's so much payoff, and that's the thing. It's like, we're only on episode 4. There's so much more still to come. So that thread is very important. And they were certainly paying a lot of attention to that. And, you know, even my like little moment where he's like, Miss Lewis, and I'm like, Dr. Lewis, like, you know, even something that seems very small is actually really big, especially, we could talk about women in the workplace forever, but you know, it's those moments that are good to see. It's a good move.
So my last question for you is about this character poster of you that was released today that, you know, everyone is sort of pouring over with their magnifying glass. Given that, you know, this is a story about, you know, someone named Scarlet Witch that we're in the realm of witchcraft, what are we to make of the fact that there's like this weird image of, that looks like you're almost having a scarlet letters on your chest. What should we make of that?
Yeah, well, obviously it's interesting. It's mysterious, and you will find out.
What an answer. The best you can do. I understand completely. All right, that's it for me. Thank you so much, Kat. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
You too.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration. A kitchen with no space. A toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
All right, so here we are, part three. Anthony and I are going to go, a little deeper on the comic lore side of things. Anthony, I want to start by talking about the appearance of a new character. We're really excited. It's obviously Sparky the dog.
Sparky. He was cute.
He's very cute. R.I.P. Sparky. Sparky, I want to talk about animals. I'm still clinging to my animal theory, but Sparky is from the Vision comic book. Sparky is the name of the family dog in the Vision comic book by Tom King that we've talked about a couple times. And Sparky also meets his doom in that book as well. So Sparky is an unlucky pup, but
he's also not a real dog, right?
Well, I mean, what is real? Do you know? But how do you feel like Sparky does or does not fit into this idea you're talking before about whether or not these animals that we keep seeing in every episode are the manifestation of a devil character called Mephisto or something else? There is a central animal in every sitcom episode we've seen so far.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is I feel like the pet, the Sparky fits the same role in this episode that pets do kind of in general with a family. You know, when you have kids, is kids learn about death from their pet, from, you know, their dog, their cat, their goldfish. I think of the goldfish in Poltergeist, right? it's how you face the unfaceable, and then you start to think about as a kid, will I die? Will my parents die? Will my grandparents die? And some kids, of course, face actual human loss much sooner. But it's interesting that Sparky literally, not to lean into the pun, but sparks the idea in Wanda's mind about her brother and Vision being dead, and Vision wanting to confront the truth, even if it's a painful truth. So, the dog kind of gets people going. I mean, it's a very odd death, right? He dies from eating azalea leaves. I didn't know that was something dogs like to do. So just seemed a little peculiar. But what I recall about the dog in the comics was Vision created it, right? Mm-hmm. And it was like him. It was like a synthezoid, which is a word I love, which Marvel stayed away from for a long time. I remember, being in interviews with Kevin Feige and Joss Whedon and saying so he's going to be a synthezoid. And they're that's a little, I think that word just scared them away because it was so geeky.
Yeah.
Like synthesoid, you push up your horn-rimmed glasses and it's clear, like you say, there's always an animal in the mix on each one of these episodes: the stork, the lobster, the bunny, and now the puppy.
Yeah.
What do you think's up?
Yeah, okay, so speaking of deeply nerdy things that as soon as you say it, people are like, why am I listening to this podcast? What do you know about the Wendigore Everbloom?
Is this where I pretend? All right, give me a sec. That's a great question, Googles furiously.
Let me put you out of your misery. So the Wendigore Everbloom is this plant that exists in the Vision comics that is grown in the shadow of the mountain of the whatever. And it has this very interesting property in that I'm pretty sure it's you have to eat it, and then a creature has to eat it,
And then that creature has to die, and then you have to eat that creature. And once you've consumed, I know this is creepy. And once you've consumed it twice, then you can see the future. this is a thing that happens in the Vision comics. And so what's interesting in the Vision comics is that Agatha, the character of Agatha Harkness, who we believe is Agnes, Catherine Hahn's character in this show, has a familiar, named Ebony, a black cat who can shapeshift. And what Agatha does in that comics is she has her cat, her familiar, eat the leaves, and then she eats her cat so that she can see the future. I know, all very gruesome, but like, this dog died eating azalea leaves. And I was like, interesting. And like, it made me start to think, like, I still feel like the animals in every episode are significant, but like, maybe this animal is just like, Agnes's familiar, and it just takes a different shape in every episode.
Good catch. You know, I definitely thought that leaf eating was a strange way to go because, you know, I've grown azaleas outside, and I don't ever encounter like a dog coming in like wolfing down the leaves and dying. So it just seems strange. Yeah. And I think you're onto something that might be a little much, like the killing an animal and eating its corpse, like for Disney Plus. I think that's a bit, but I'm gonna definitely points to you for catching that one.
I mean, we'll see. It sort of put me on the track of like, is this actually just her familiar? More so than like, there are definitely leaves here where you can see the future. But it felt like maybe a reference to that, perhaps, or you know, sometimes a drone is just a drone. But I definitely think there's something very suspicious about Agnes being the one to like, we only have her word for it, that that's how the dog died, right? And like, Richard and I talked about this a little bit, but like in the first half, but it seems like Agnes is very invested in growing those kids. Like, she spritzed them with something and then they grew. And then it seemed like this dog thing was her pushing them to grow some more. So if she's, you know, as we've discussed before, if she's sort of for her reason, for her ends or someone else's, incubating these children and trying to get them to grow to maturity, the dog is all part of that.
Do you know? So then also, didn't she bring over a plant in like the first episode? When she says charmed and like brings them a welcome gift, doesn't she bring them a plant? She's always bringing gifts and over. So what is, you know, like the doghouse?
And I mean, what's interesting is in the Vision comics, Agatha had given Wanda and Vision that Wendigor Everbloom as a wedding, like upon the occasion of their wedding, as a gift to them. So, you know, it's all, I'd keep my eye on any gift from Agnes, Agatha, that's for sure. Whatever it may mean.
Yes. So, we'll see. Got it. All right.
I want to talk to you, before we get to like all the Evan Peters stuff, which we definitely will talk about some more. I want to talk to you about what's going on with Monica. Monica Rambeau. What's your sense of what's happening right now?
Okay, so the thing that jumps out at me the most, and I'm not sure if this is where you're going, but like she's getting like a physical, right? And it's make sure she's A-okay after going into the hex. I said hex. Mm-hmm. We're making it work.
You did. It's catching on.
And then she was like, the technician was like, actually going to have to retake these because they were just all blown out, right? Like the light, it was just like a blast of light. And that, I do not think that was accidental. There's no fat on these episodes. So like that was, again, something we were supposed to notice. And we learned that, Wanda morphs whatever you bring into her universe to fit the time and space, that it's real. It's not just like a mirage. Monica's bulletproof vest became like morphed into her like 70s disco outfit or what have you. So it's now bulletproof, which she proves by shooting a gun in the complex, which I thought was really irresponsible. You know,
very, very extra.
You know, like I just pictured like somebody behind in the cubicle beyond that just being like, oh. What does that do to the human body, right? And if you pass through into the hex, like so far, I guess there's the beekeeper guy. We haven't heard about what happened to him. And we never really met him. I mean, maybe.
I'm worried that he got blipped, but like, yeah, the question is, what does going, you know, Darcy in episode 4 spent a lot of time talking about like the, like, I don't know if she called it like microwave energy, like the massive amount of energy on this bubble on the hex, right? And Monica not only goes through it in the first place, she gets shooting back out it in the second place. And if that's not an inciting incident for a superhero, I don't know what is. And something like we know, right, is that Monica Rambeau in the comics is a superhero called Photon. And if you look at the character poster that they the character poster that they're releasing for WandaVision are so fascinating. They're all the same in terms of you have the character standing behind a little pile of monitors and you see different images on each monitor and it gives you like a little different piece of the puzzle. If you look at Monica Rambeau's character poster, one of the monitor that's sort of right in front of like where her hip is, you see something that looks to me like it could be the hip of a Photon costume. So if we saw her fully in costume before the end of this series, there's only a few more episodes to go. That would be wild. But like this, I think we just saw the creation of a new superhero.
I'm with you. Sure. You know, in comics lore, Monica Rambeau becomes Captain Marvel, and a lot of people have been talking about ever since she appeared as like a little girl in Captain Marvel, the movie. Like eventually she's going to grow up and take on the mantle of Captain Marvel. And that's a common thing in Marvel and comics in general, is different characters take on the role of like the iconic superhero, you know, everything from Peter Parker handing off, or, you know, Spider-Man becoming Miles Morales, or, Falcon becoming the Captain America. Like they sometimes just, I think the writers switch it up. But Monica has her own identity too, like, and I think establishes herself as Photon in the comics. Similarly, like cosmic power kind of superhero. And yeah, I think this is a great way to introduce that. And I think, you know, we already have like a current Captain Marvel for a while, and I think they'll stick with that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe for a little bit. So this gives Monica a chance to power up on her own, be her own thing. I dig it.
The other thing we should note about Monica in this episode is that it seems to me, my interpretation of her reaction to a mention of Carol, is that she is ticked off at her mom's best friend, like who is like almost like another mom to her. I have my theories as to why that might be, but did you pick up on that? Did that ping
it
again
definitely
for you?
Was like an enigmatic response, right? It wasn't like, oh yeah, good old Captain Marvel. Like it was like, yeah. So what's your theory? Is there a little bit of like, you left us?
That's what I think. Like, so, and to circle back to Photon really quickly, Photon, we've seen a couple times, was her mom's call sign, was Monica's mom's call sign as a pilot. And we've seen that plaque a couple times at Sword headquarters where it's like Maria Photon Rambeau and stuff like that. So, you know, she could just take on her mom's name and that could be her superhero moniker. That's my sense, is that she's like, you left us. Mom got cancer and died and you left us and never came back. And I believe it has been announced that Tiana Paris is in Captain Marvel 2, which is, I think, shooting right now. So we might see some of that drama play out there.
Do we know when Captain Marvel 2 is set? What the timeline is?
We don't, but if Tiana Paris is in it, then now-ish, not in a prequel way, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would expect, but like, you never know. The way they're playing with timelines. So that's why I kind of wondered. Is like, what?
It's true.
How much is she in it? Is it a framing device? Could be anything. You know, we just don't know. Anyway, I just wasn't sure about that. But okay. Here's another thing. This is a little bit of a side tangent. You and I are sitting here talking about Monica Rambeau. Emphasis on the bow. On the show, they call her Rambo. Like, Isn't that true? I the only one who's a little distracted whenever they're like, Captain Rambo is going to be presenting to us? And I'm just like, I'm your worst nightmare. Like, I just can't stop thinking of Sylvester Stallone. It's Rambo. Like, I feel like they just need a little more emphasis on the bow.
Put more New Orleans on it.
A little bit,
it.
Right?
On,
I mean, it just feels
Captain
Rambo.
But I do want to stay with.
Sorry,
with,
conversation stopper.
No. It brings me to the next thing I want to talk about, which is what's going on with Sword. So I think you're the one who pointed out last week that we might want to like keep our eye on the current director of Sword. His name's Tyler Hayward, I think is right. There's something maybe off about him. There's a couple options here. Like, is he a Skrull? We've seen Skrulls. If you watch the first Captain Marvel movie, Skrulls are shape-shifting aliens who might like to insinuate themselves in the higher halls of power in certain organizations in order to control things. Is he Hydra? Hydra also likes to do that. You know, there's no shortage of people who like to infiltrate, top positions at various organizations in the Marvel, universe, right? But what we learn in this episode is that number one, Vision did not want to become a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, Sword had pieces of Vision in a lab for 5 years after his death and seemed to be experimenting on him. Director Hayward sort of positions this as Wanda like going, you know, bananas and you know, boosting his body, and she's
like
the villain.
She's
here,
defying
but like,
his living
know,
will, is what he said.
Yeah. But like if he was already experimenting on Vision to try to create a weapon, then she is, you know, in a sense, saving Vision's body from something that he didn't want to have happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. He's clear. I think he's clearly, I don't know if he's the big bad, but he's a bad guy on this show, right?
No.
He's become a real jerk, and he's murderous when he doesn't need to be. He's rude.
He's escalating things.
He's not cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like he's just pushing his own agenda. Like, to me, if I think of it as this way of, like, his primary motivation is to get Vision's body back so he can keep doing the, like, artificial intelligence work that he was doing with that. That helps, that helps underline why he's so invested in just, like, taking Wanda off the board. And taking her off the board in a way where she's not even allowed to, like, tell her side of the story.
Yes, he doesn't want her questioned. And that's pretty clear. Like, take the shot. Like, what? She's just standing there, dude. Like, that was okay. Here's another moment where Monica's like trying to talk to her. She's like, "Can you hear me?" And then we cut to Wanda, and there's no audio, right? So I don't even think the drone was broadcasting to her. Like, they set her up in that way. She thinks she's flying in to talk to her, and they're actually flying in to kill her. Am I right? I don't know.
Exactly.
You can tell me if I'm wrong.
I think you're right.
That. Like, if I just misinterpreted it, but like,
no.
Seemed like it was they didn't want her addressing Wanda, and so there wasn't the capability.
Don't talk to her. We, you know, this is a kill mission only sort of thing. And Wanda's anger at him, like, she seemed to know who he was, and you know, when she has everyone aim their guns at him, like, you know, she might be angry at whatever it was he was planning to do with Vision. Do you know? So that, I mean, that maybe that's reaching, but I think whenever we see surveillance video and some like guy is telling me what I'm looking at, I'm like, I would like to see it from a different angle, please. I would like the full story, please. There's also this fun little cutaway moment where Jimmy Woo and Darcy Lewis are talking about Hayward as he's briefing, and they do a little like PG cutaway from Darcy calling him a dick, but they cut back on
terrorist.
The word terrorist. Yeah.
That was a clever cut.
So, So keep your eye on that dude. Not good news, is I think what's pretty clear. And then let's see what else. Let's talk about the aerospace.
Oh, I was just
going to
say.
Right?
Before we, I was going to, we're right on the same page here. I was going to say, like, can we talk about Sword's up to? Because at the beginning, they're walking down the hall when Monica's like, I'm back from being blipped. what's up? I'm kind of on hiatus or whatever they call it. Like you're sort of on, like you're grounded or what have you. But they're talking about like astronaut training, and there's clearly like a lot of engineering going on there. So, and that brings us to, this is after they test the clothes, right? And they determine like that it's changing. What is it? She says we need to summon an I have a friend, like we'll get an aerospace engineer, but what was it that they needed that person for again?
I thought it was about sort of trying to figure out how to permeate bubble in a way.
Oh, yeah. They were going to build we need like this, you know, 10 feet of lead or whatever.
A battering ram.
Like, yeah, to get it. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Take it away, Joe.
No, I mean, like, what's your I think, as you said, there's no fat on the show. So if Monica's like, I've got an aerospace engineer friend, a million nerdy Marvel people are pricking up their ears. What do you think? What's your theory as to whom that might be?
I think it's going to be somebody new, at least to Marvel Cinema. It'd be somebody we recognize, but I think somebody we know from comics, but somebody who hasn't perhaps been in the MCU yet. A lot of folks automatically went to Rhodey, you know, War Machine, Don Cheadle's character. He's definitely got like engineering expertise, but he's a pilot. You know, that's his main area of expertise. So I'm like, maybe him. Like, if Tony Stark were still alive, I would say Tony Stark. He's definitely an engineer, definitely an aerospace guy. The most famous engineer in Marvel lore is Dr. Doom and Reed Richards, who are, of course, rivals in the Fantastic Four. And then in my mind also went to Letitia Wright's character, Shuri. Although, you know, she's a brilliant scientist, engineer, head of Wakanda's science division. But, you know, I don't know that Shuri would be bothering much with S.W.O.R.D., you know, given that Wakanda likes to keep to itself and do its own thing. So, you know, those are some of the possibilities. What do you think?
So a couple things. So the first reaction I saw from people is like, oh, it's definitely Reed Richards, which feels a little premature because though Marvel has announced that they are going to be doing Fantastic Four was sort of the end of Kevin Feige's presentation to the Disney investors last year. So they're doing Fantastic Four. There's strong rumors that like they're out to John Krasinski and Emily Blunt. John Krasinski to take on the role of Reed Richards. That's a really fun idea because both Krasinski and Blunt, you know, were in the running to play Captain America and Black Widow respectively once upon a time. And so that's like a really fun casting rumor for Fantastic Four, but it still feels so early to bring in a Reed Richards given like how far out that plan is. Right. So
it does feel early, but they did announce, the director for that,
it's John Watts. John Watts, right?
John Watts Spider-Man. Yeah. And you know, I don't know.
But I have another piece of information, though, which is someone noted that on the this is one of my favorite. When you have like a mystery theory show, fans go all out. And here's one of my favorite things that they do sometimes. Foreign or non-English subtitles or dubbing.
Oh, yes.
Aerospace engineer is gendered, and it's gendered female. So, a female aerospace engineer. You said Letitia Wright. I'm posed to you Riri Williams, Ironheart.
Oh.
So you said, if Tony Stark was still alive, Tony Stark... Riri Williams, who has been cast, Dominique Thorne is going to be playing Riri Williams. They're doing an Ironheart TV show. Do you want to tell the folks who Ironheart is?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, who the character is or the casting?
Well, basically, right, this is like a young woman who takes on the Iron Man sort of mantle in the comics as Ironheart.
She's
like a preternaturally talented scientist, right?
Yeah, she's a young woman who, as you say, she takes on... We talked about switching the mantles, right? Like different characters take on like the title of a famous superhero. And, you know, she takes on basically the, I guess you would say, like, sort of the powers of Iron Man, but she calls herself Iron Heart, and it's clearly like a different outfit and all that, and she's a different personality, but she's a very, like, I love that character, and she's relatively new. Like, she's just the last few years been introduced. And, you know, I think you hit on it.
I mean, one of our listeners actually is the one who suggested it to me. So I don't want to take any credit. That was some information from a listener. But I was like fully on the Reed Richards train. And so someone was like, Riri Williams. I was like, ooh, I like it better.
The other interesting thing is, I mean, they have cast someone as Riri Williams. They announced it as part of that Disney massive investor call where they revealed all these upcoming projects. So you have somebody in the role, and that is actress Dominique Thorne. So why announce that early? Marvel doesn't like to announce things until they have a reason to. And I think, if we could get this brilliant aerospace engineer to turn up, and it's Ironheart, it's Riri Williams, then we're set. We're off to the races. And they have built in a little preview of the Ironheart series that they're planning to develop.
I mean, I think, you know, like I keep saying, we're going to talk about Evan Peters and Quicksilver, but I think we have underestimated how linked all of these properties are going to be. Because in this episode alone, we have a launching off for some Captain Marvel 2 stuff, right? With whatever is happening with Monica and Carol. And then if Riri shows up, that's an Ironheart offshoot. You know, I just think that there's options for, I just don't envy Kevin Feige and everyone at Marvel trying to keep all these like, plates spinning. But, you know, that seems to be the challenge that they've set themselves. So here we go. The last thing, science-based thing that I want to talk about, I think, is this idea. So they talk in this episode about like, okay, so the Mind Stone, as we've mentioned, powers Wanda and it powers Vision. Like they have this like twin Mind Stone powering. She's puppeting his corpse around Westview, it would appear. Ooh. And Darcy and was sort of wondering like, how is he going without the Mind Stone? Like, how is that happening? And we talked about, like, you know, the work that Shuri might have done in Infinity War to try to start that. Sorry, you had an intake of breath as if there was something you wanted to say about that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if that was Shuri's task in Infinity War. It was like, let's rewire Vision so that we can destroy the stone. And then he won't be able to, you know, then Thanos won't be able to do his thing. So,
Something I've been thinking about is that, you know, Kevin Feige, when he talked to us, he said, well, you know, when we were picking these various characters to populate the world, Jimmy Woo, Darcy Lewis, we knew we needed a scientist. And we were like, oh, we've got Darcy. I mean, Darcy was a political... I talked to Kat Dennings about this in the interview that's in this week's episode. She's a political scientist. Now she's got a doctorate in other science. But, like, is there a world in which Darcy, helps finish the job that Shuri started and gives Vision a new life, not dependent on Wanda's magic to sort of keep him going?
If anything's possible. That's Shuri is a tough act to follow.
True. So true. Know? Very true.
She's,
she's
pretty high intellect there, but maybe they, you know, if she teams up with Riri and they could put their heads together, I'm sure anything is possible. And, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I do think that we are going to leave this with some closure or resurrection for Vision. You know, the problem with Vision, and this was alluded to a little bit in this episode, is also the problem with Scarlet Witch, which I thought it was interesting. There was that beat where they're like, didn't she have an interesting, like, colorful nickname? And they're like, no. Did they never mention the name Scarlet Witch?
Yeah, so I did want to talk about that, actually. I was going back. This is why before we started recording, I was asking you if you remembered Comic-Con 2019 a million years ago. But they said something on stage at Comic-Con about, like, we'll finally see why Wanda is called, like, she'll finally become Scarlet Witch. So I kind of feel like
You know, we've talked about this idea of like Wanda having two kinds of powers. There's like the Infinity Stone power, but there's also sort of like some, the witchier power.
Yeah,
Let me go off on a quick random tangent, which is sort of connected, which is that there's a theory that I like that maybe Wanda sacrifices, if she can in some way, her infinity, whatever Infinity Stone power she has, to keep Vision alive. You know, I don't know how that would work, but let's say she does. I don't think that leaves her without powers. I just think that leaves her significantly powered down, that she's still like witchy and powerful, but not reality shakingly powerful. She's always been too powerful. Vision's always been too powerful, right, for the Marvel universe. So I like this idea. I like the idea that like if Vision and Wanda can come out of this both still alive but less powerful versions of themselves, and then they can continue to exist in the Marvel universe. And so like we know that that Wanda is going to be in Doctor Strange 2, and there's like two ways that that could happen. One, she could end this series as the big bad, the scary villainous Scarlet Witch, you took my suburbs from me, I'm going to kill everyone sort of thing. And she, Doctor Strange, has to battle her. Or she could walk out of this powered down somewhat, and perhaps she has to learn from Doctor Strange how to master these other powers that she has. Does that make any sense?
It makes a ton of sense. And that was what I was going to add
earlier
is, you know, the trouble with them, the trouble in quotes, is they're so powerful that they end any threat. And I think they even allude to that, like, oh yeah, Wanda could have taken out Thanos, just like Captain Marvel. That's where the Captain Marvel name drop comes in. And the thing is, you don't want heroes that are too powerful, because that you need adversity in the story, right? So you need them to be like, you know, the underdog at some point. So I think that if they can emerge intact, right, like the Vision is back and alive, but not maybe like quite as miraculous as he originated, and Wanda also sees some sort of diminishment of her powers, like that just makes it easier for them to exist in the story. It's kind of like cell phones and time travel in narratives. Mm-hmm. Like the time travel device always has to get broken, because otherwise you're just like, oh, there's a problem. You know, it's like Vanilla Ice. If you got a problem, I'll solve it. Just let's rewind it instead of revolve it.
Uh-huh.
Like, so you have to have you have to have Marty McFly like not have plutonium for his for the DeLorean, because otherwise the story ends. And like in horror movies or what have you, like, well, you could just call for help with your cell phone. So you always have to like set it in the 80s when there were no cell phones, or have the cell phone break, or we don't have a signal here. You know what I mean? So it's like, you've got to take the
forever
signal away
on the X-Files.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right.
Forever like on the X-Files, their cell phones were breaking. Yeah.
You know, so I think you've got to like break the cell phone of the Vision and Wanda and that's why maybe the way they handle that with Captain Marvel is that's the thing, is that she's not here. So she can't use her phenomenal cosmic powers to solve every problem.
Yeah, that was the big problem with Captain Marvel, is like they wanted to do this 90s movie, and that's really fun. But how do you explain why Captain Marvel didn't like solve every problem in the previous Marvel movies we saw with a flick of her wrist? You know, she's so powerful. And the answer was, let's just send her to space for a few decades until we really need her, and then we'll bring her back. And the same is true of like Wanda and Vision. We've been talking about this for years. The way in which they've had to sort of like sideline them or whatever ever since, Joss put them in Ultron, I think not really thinking through what that would do, you know, especially for something like Civil War, where you're trying to have a superhero matchup and you've got players like Vision and Wanda on the board. And so like what you have to do is sort of like
give them internal drama where they're focused on fighting each other. So like, let the gods fight over there and we mere superhero mortals will fight over here. So if a prompt of WandaVision, here's what I think the way that Marvel thinks about these things, and they're so smart and they plan these things way out in advance, but they're like, we have a few problems that we need to solve. We need to introduce the multiverse. We need to power Wanda and Vision down. We need to do like various things. And I feel like that's what we're watching happen in WandaVision. You know, how do we solve a problem like Wanda Maximoff? We make her.
How do you solve a problem mm-hmm. like Wanda Maximoff?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh, we're going to have to pay for that.
One last detail before we go into the bubble, which is we got to look at Darcy's character poster. And I sent this to you, Anthony, and I was like, please help me understand this. As I mentioned with Monica's character poster, we see around her hip section something that looks like maybe a Photon superhero costume. With Darcy, we see in her shoulder sort of, you know, sternum region, a costume that does not look modern in any way, or at least looks costumey. There's these two red sort of S insignias on something that could be like a sweater, could be something older. You know, there's a fun theory that like Kat Dennings, you don't hire Kat Dennings and Randall Park for a show about sitcoms, two sitcom actors for a show about sitcoms if you're not going to send them into the bubble. So I like this idea of like the bubble either expanding. We saw its walls sort of do some stuff in this episode. The bubble either expanding and swallowing Sword, so we could get like a sitcom mm-hmm. version of Sword, or them permeating the bubble. But like Kat Dennings in our interview in this episode very diplomatically refused to answer my question about her costume, but did say like we've only just sort of begun to see what's going to happen for her character. So do you have any thoughts or feelings or theories about that?
I tried very hard to figure out what those symbols are, and I'm searching like, you know, alchemy symbols and ancient runes and old Led Zeppelin albums, like all of the mystical texts. And like, I just couldn't place it. There's symmetry there. You and I eventually came to like a understanding. Maybe it's like a Scarlet Letter kind of thing. That's a, you know, the Nathaniel Hawthorne story set back in the Puritan times. So we got a little bit of potential witchcraft there that could thread in. But yeah, otherwise maybe it's just a symbol. Like maybe it's just a pattern or a design for a retro sweater. But they're not really in retro times anymore. So if she were to go through the bubble, she'd be now in like the 90s because we just had the 80s.
A theory that I love, well, actually, I've only just kind of half come up with it, so I'm going to take credit for this, which is that if the bubble, the bubble expanding idea is interesting to me, like the bubble growing and swallowing this encampment that we're seeing, and something that I've been, a circle that I've been trying to square, or a square I've been trying to circle, whatever the phrase is when they've talked about not the 90s episode, which we presume is next, but the aughts episode that comes after that. The two shows that they've referenced are Modern Family and The Office in this sort of like fun meta direct address mockumentary style. Both Modern Family and The Office have this these confessional sections, right, of their shows. And in a recent trailer, we saw Elizabeth Olsen sort of like in her robe and pajamas talking to the camera, being like, I don't know, maybe it's just a case of the Mondays, like doing a very like Modern Family sitcom direct address. But what if the bubble does expand, swallows up Sword, and we get Sword : The Office, and we get like a workplace sitcom, but make it Sword? What do you think of that idea?
I love it. I mean, because really, you know, The Office tried to keep the documentary crew like a part of the story for a very long time. There were scenes where they like take off their microphone or, you know, reference the doc team. But really, the documentary team couldn't be there. And I think there was even a joke once where Michael Scott was like, wow, you guys have really been here a long time. You know, it's like you got quite a grant there to continue this project. But with Parks and Rec, and Modern Family, it really just became a kind of like cinematic language. The same yeah. way we got used to scores in films, right? Like it used to be once talkies were introduced and you had like sound that was merged with the picture. They would do things like in the Bela Lugosi Dracula movie, like if you wanted to have music to set a mood, you would have to have like a little chamber orchestra there, like in the chamber, you know, like and show them playing. And that music is explained, like that's why you're hearing music, because there's music in this scene. But really its effect was to conjure a feeling. And then gradually they stopped having to like say there's actual music being played in this scene. Mm-hmm. And it just becomes yeah. something that as viewers, we accept, that we learn as a part of a language, just like we learn language as children. You know, this is what these sounds, words mean. This is what these gestures mean. We learn communication. And I think like the mockumentary format became, I mean, it kind of started with Christopher Guest, right? Or, you know, or This Is Spinal Tap and Rob Reiner.
Mm-hmm.
Just so Christopher Guest. But like then The Office, and then finally the last stage, I think, was Parks and Rec, which just said, Modern Family, this is just, there isn't really a documentary team here. We're just doing these little interstitials and you're hearing the thoughts of the characters. And then we're going back to the show.
Yeah.
You know, back to the narrative. And yeah. it just becomes something that you kind of accept as cinematic language. So I think they could do that. Sorry for my, this is the term paper I'm writing for my media literacy class. You know, I just think it's always interesting when some new part of language evolves, and that's what this is. So yeah, if we get that with Shield, with Sword, I'm all for it. I think that'd be really kind of cool. And definitely, like, if we're talking about, like, Dick Van Dyke's show being one of the things that established, like, the language of a sitcom.
Yeah.
And how that changed with the Brady Bunch and then Family Ties. And I saw some people comparing this to Full House, too, which is interesting because Elizabeth Olsen's sisters, of course, were the Olsen twins from that show. And you have two twins on this program as well. So real life begins to connect to fantasy life, and the language of the entertainment we consume is part of the meta enjoyment
yeah.
that we have of watching WandaVision. So it's all quite a mix of flavors we've got here from Marvel Studios.
I think it's just so funny because, like, you know, as we mentioned last week, sometimes a drone is just a drone, and sometimes, but like chasing these like weird theories is really fun for me. And so, like, I just love that, like, last week or earlier this week, I had convinced myself that. Whatever it is that Kat Dennings is wearing in that character poster meant she was going back to like puritanical witch times. And now I'm like, what if it's just The Office? Cause you know, Kat Dennings has such like, and I think she mentioned this in her conversation with me. She has such like a 50s aesthetic to her that I could just like see, an office version of her where she wears like really fun, beautiful, sweater sets and stuff like that. Like that's something that I could definitely see her wearing, you know?
Yeah. And Pam Beasley on The Office had, like, sweaters were her thing,
oh,
right?
Totally. Pam.
Was, like, one of her signatures.
Phyllis. All the ladies were wearing sweaters in The Office. So, yeah, you know, this, like...
You know, Dunder Mifflin was a cheap company. I could see them keeping the heat low.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got to, like, you know, cozy up.
Sweater up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I love the idea of, like, an aughts episode where we get to cut to, like, Randall Park and Kat Dennings, like, commenting on... their jerk boss and all this other stuff that might be happening there, you know,
a gym style yeah. eye roll.
Well, and also wasn't Randall Park on The Office as
oh, he was fake,
yeah,
Jim.
Fake Jim,
yeah, wasn't he?
Yeah, Asian Jim. So you know, the layers, they just keep coming.
Oh, it's okay. Now I gotta watch. Is that scene? I guess, is that scene all right, or are we allowed to laugh at that one still? Or
I don't know. I will have to recheck as well. I haven't rewatched it.
What's interesting, I haven't thought of that scene in so long, but like, and God, what year was it? I don't know, but like early gaslighting, right? Like, oh no, this is always the way I've looked, and here's a photo of me with my family. Like, he just totally gaslights Dwight into thinking, until he's really questioning his own perception.
I mean, I think that like,
and now 4 years later, we all, we, you know, after, you know, not to get political, but like gaslighting is like, a major part of our understanding of the political world. Yeah, so,
that's true. I like the idea of Riri Williams, to circle back. I like the idea of Riri Williams coming in, but like, I mean, it would be next level hilarious if John Krasinski as Richards came in time to get to do like some sort of office thing on WandaVision. That would be, you know, phenomenal. But I don't know. It just, that feels like such a heavy lift, but you know.
Maybe that's the big cameo that she was.
John Krasinski as Jim on WandaVision, like, you know.
That would be pretty funny.
That would be a lot. It would be a lot. Mm-hmm. All right. So, let's talk about that. Okay. Let's talk about cameos and appearances. We've gone long enough. Let's talk about Evan Peters and multiverses. So to recap really quickly, in case you don't obsessively follow these narratives on Twitter like I do, Elizabeth Olsen said in an interview with TV Line that there was a cameo coming, that had been kept under wraps. And the way it was phrased in that article, I think, was a little misleading. Not her quote, but the way it was positioned next to the interviewers, editorializing about how this could be like on the level of Luke Skywalker in The Mandalorian. But basically, Elizabeth Olsen was just saying there was something big coming that she was surprised hadn't gotten out there yet. If you've been listening to this podcast, you know that we were already pretty sure that Evan Peters was showing up. So I don't know that that's what she was talking about. But let's talk about Evan Peters showing up here on WandaVision. What did you think of the implications of a Fox Quicksilver showing up in a Marvel TV show, Anthony?
They're clearly like, okay, so I think the reasons for that go well beyond the Wanda story that we're exploring.
Yeah.
Like, okay, Disney purchased Fox. They now have the rights back to the X-Men. They own those movies. What do you do with them? Because they're not connected to the current universe. And this is a way to merge them, right? And they're also venturing toward this multiverse idea, which is something the DC films and TV shows have already, you know, it pretty well established in their narrative. And it's a way of really embracing fans of different interpretations of the characters. Marvel's big thing was it's all linked. It's all one story. And the multiverse approach says it's all one story still, but you can have different levels and different worlds where the same characters are presented differently. You know, it's kind of what Stephen King did with his Dark Tower narrative, which is like there are various levels of reality and they're all connected in one structure, but they, you know, they exist in and of themselves and there are some similarities and some major differences. And so what we have here is one of the major differences linked with one of the similarities, which is she has a brother, Pietro, but he's played by the guy who played Pietro in this other property, not by Aaron Taylor-Johnson from the world we've already seen. So is it a way of poking a hole into the apartment next door, which is where the Fox X-Men stories are living, and letting some of those things come through and merge? I think that seems to be sort of the more likely scenario. This is a way of saying we're going to pick and choose from that toy box what we want to have in ours.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
And we are, yeah, no, absolutely. And we already know that they are doing something similar in Spider-Man 3, where we've got Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield well, Andrew Garfield pretty much confirmed, Tobey Maguire rumored to be these other Spider-Men to be in the Spider-Man film. And something that Kevin Feige has said is this idea of this multiverse thread is something that is going to start here with WandaVision. Go through Spider-Man 3. I just like saying Spider-Man as if it's someone's last name. Spider-Man,
yeah, the
3.
Spider-Man's down the street. Really nice family.
Oh, you know. Peter Spider-Man. Anyway, Spider-Man 3. And then maybe concluding or reaching a fever pitch or whatever in Doctor Strange 2. That this is like – and like it's wild to me that if they're going to crack the multiverse open that – it's happening here in episode 5 of WandaVision. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, in case there's any questions, because there's some doubt and rightly so, that like, is this actually Pietro? I think his name is Peter, actually, in the X-Men films. Pietro/Peter from the Fox films. Or is this like a villainous Mephisto or something like that, sort of pretending to be Pietro? But I will say that there's something, once again, the captions or subtitles come in to save us. There is an option on Disney Plus that you can have audio descriptions, I believe for the seeing impaired, so that they can understand what's happening wordlessly. And the audio description for this moment says, in Westview, Wanda stares at the version of Pietro from the X-Men films. So that's feels pretty pretty clear that that's what they're doing here. It's not just like a joke that Evan Peters is here. Like, this is actually, that's who's here.
And his performance as the brother is worth it. Can we talk about that too? The accent he's doing?
Absolutely.
Like, okay, who did you think of from TV history? So we talked about like Tom Hanks playing like the wacky uncle who turns out to have like a really sad, real backstory in Family Ties of his, you know, his struggle with alcoholism. And so then the uncle shows up here and he's clearly wacky and in capital letters. And he's speaking with like a kind of, I don't know if it's like a Jersey accent or a New York accent, but does he remind you of any character from TV history past?
Okay. You're obviously trying to prompt me for something, but the first thing that came to my mind, only because you've mentioned Full House, would be like Uncle Jesse, John Stamos. I don't know. What do you think?
Yes. I mean, clearly like the rebel uncle, right? But also,
with the leather jacket.
Like, the way he's playing it reminds me so much of John Travolta from Welcome Back, Kotter. Like, hey!
Oh, hey! Up your
nose with a rubber hose, you know? Like, like or the Fonz, you know? Like,
Yeah.
Who were these like, greaser characters? I guess that's what you'd call them, right? Like, the 50s, like, slick back hair, leather jacket, like, working on your car kind of characters who like they all seem to like populate ultra white suburbia. Like just pop up a random Jersey guy, you know, like just I guess Welcome Back, Kotter was like all set in like you know, the city, but like it just feels like the Fonz. What was the Fonz doing there? I don't know. I just didn't.
Hey.
Hey.
Oh my God. I love to, well, now I want Henry Winkler to be the cameo that she's talking about. Anyway, to go back to this cameo, I don't think that Evan Peters fulfills the prompt for this like big cameo that nobody knows or this big appearance that nobody knows about. It could just be Benedict Cumberbatch. But something that we mentioned before when we were sort of going down the like Bryan Cranston, John Goodman theorizing rabbit hole was this quote from Paul Bettany where he said, there's an actor I've been like dying to work with and we have fireworks. I don't think he's talking about Evan Peters, with all respect to Evan Peters. Yeah. I don't think Paul Bettany like was like writing in his dream journal every night, please let me work with Evan Peters. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, this has led me to like triangulate people's guesses against whether or not Paul Bettany has worked with them. So like some people are wondering, and it can't be Benedict Cumberbatch because Paul Bettany worked with him in the film Creation. It couldn't be Ian McKellen because they were in the Da Vinci Code together. And Patrick Stewart is a fun guest, like people, because people think, okay, Quicksilver's here from Fox. Who else from Fox is coming over in this show, right? Magneto is a big guest because in the comics, Magneto is Wanda's father, right? So Ian McKellen or Michael Fassbender, something people are wondering about. Patrick Stewart or James McAvoy. Patrick Stewart said he met with Kevin Feige, but also said he told Kevin Feige, no, thank you. like that he's like, I did Logan and now I'm done. Thank you very much. No, thank you. So, if he's telling the truth, then we could take Patrick Stewart off the board. But it's just fun to think of like potential X-Men characters. I mean, that's the whole point of cracking the multiverse open, right? Like, who's gonna come streaming in?
Yeah,
there's a lot of rumors that Charlie Cox's Daredevil's gonna be in the Spider-Man movie. That's fun. That's the Netflix world, the Sony world, the Fox world. It's all these action figures are now on the board for Feige and company to play with. So
yeah, for sure. And it's, you know, it's a matter of what works, right? Let's keep what works. Let's not exactly. worry about what doesn't. Let that
exactly.
be
it's such a clever way for Feige to like look at these other properties, because I, you know, like he's so politic. He's never like trashed these other things, but I'm happy to trash them for him and say like there's plenty about the Netflix shows that didn't work. There's plenty about the X-Men, the Fox X-Men movies that didn't work, but I think Evan Peters worked. I think his Quicksilver little interludes were so fun in those movies. And I think Charlie Cox's Daredevil really worked. Like, Iron Fist can stay. Like, we don't need to bring him over, right? But, like, let's bring Daredevil over. We like Charlie Cox. Mm-hmm. Why not? You know? So, like, let's just pluck what works and leave what doesn't and roll forward from there, you know?
So, okay. So, question here for you. Yeah. Could the actor that Bettany is talking about being excited to work with be Fassbender? Did we eliminate him from the board? Am I?
I don't have him off the board yet. No.
But they haven't worked together, have they?
I know. I don't think so. He's on the board.
So that could be. That could be it.
It could be it. It could be it. So
I think one of the things that holds me back from like Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, and I don't mean this to sound ageist, but they're older gentlemen. You know, they're getting up there, and you want these if you're going to introduce these characters and have them around for 10 years, you want to make sure that you know, that it's not an 80 something person, right? You want Fassbender to be Magneto and be able to be in action scenes and do things like that. So I think, look, that's why they kind of did that with X-Men First Class, is recast the characters, but then you have the older actors kind of playing them as framing devices and so forth. But you want to hand off the, just like we talked about handing the mantle of the iconic character or the iconic hero to another character in the comic book universe, you hand the character to another actor and bring it to life. So maybe Fassbender shows up as Wanda and Pietro's father, long lost, never could be spoken of before due to rights violations, but helps bring them out of it. I don't know.
We do get
But then we have that thing that their parents died, right? So that was
isn't in the comics, like Wanda finds out later in life that she's Magneto's. She's actually Magneto's kid, right? So another big aspect of this that we haven't really explicitly talked about is that Pietro or Peter, as played by Evan Peters, is a mutant. That's a mutant, and that's the first mutant in a Marvel. You know, they've had like, I forget what they called them in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Specials, something like, or I don't know. Anyway, they've skirted around it, around the fact that they couldn't use the word mutant because they didn't have the rights to it because Fox owned it. So they haven't. So and when I asked Kevin Feige about like whether or not the fact that they own the word mutant now would enable them to explore Wanda's backstory through that lens, he was like, we're not going backwards with that. We're only going forwards with that. So this idea that like the multiverse cracks open and all of a sudden mutants can be part of this universe because they were part of that other universe is fun to think about, right?
Yeah, totally.
So there you go. Mutants are here. Fox is here. Welcome to the new era of Marvel storytelling. Okay, we've gone on a really long time. I just have one last thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. Are you ready? Okay, I promise. And then we'll be done. We've talked a lot about Mephisto. I go on and off the Mephisto bandwagon. You have been like very reasonable in your like, I don't know if we want to do the devil here, whatever. And I think that that's a very fair attitude. I am currently back off the I was on it. Now I'm off the Mephisto bandwagon. That's the joy of theorizing. You can change your mind week to week. It's okay. You can be wrong. It's okay. The current theory that I've really glommed onto, that I've heard circling around, is this idea that the villain here is the character of Nightmare. Have you thought at all or had any experience reading about Nightmare?
No, fill me in.
Okay, so Nightmare is basically like a demon figure, similar to Mephisto, but more explicitly in the realm of trapping people in dreams and then feeding off of them in that sort of dream world. So like this idea, yeah, that's true. So this idea of like trapping someone as powerful as Wanda in a dream world, and then feeding off of grief, perhaps. That's something that Monica mentions when she comes out of the bubble, this idea that she felt like weighed down by grief, is kind of interesting. And this idea that Nightmare, either as Agatha or controlling Agatha in some way, could be the big one behind here. And some, a little bit more information on that is that back when Scott Derrickson and Cargill were still going to do Doctor Strange 2, Cargill mentioned that Nightmare was their planned villain for that.
Hmm.
So there's a scenario I like where Doctor Strange shows up at the end of this series to sort of rescue Wanda from her own, you know, bad decisions, and thinks he's defeated Nightmare, but Nightmare is just hanging out waiting for the next opportunity, and it boils over in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. What do you think? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, like, I'm digesting.
You can say no.
I'm digesting no. here, but I think, like, I think that's great. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm on board. Like, you've sold me. Like let's see that. I love that there is still so much, that the Marvel universe is so vast, the comics universe is so vast, that you can pull out characters. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I've heard of him. I'm 100% familiar with that story. But what you described, I'm in, right? I think that'd be a cool way to set it up. Is that where WandaVision is going? Like, how much, like, they do have to be careful how much load bearing they expect this show to do in terms of setting up its future. And we have this sort of fallow period at the end of Endgame, and as Marvel is trying to, you know, launch a whole new, God, what do they call the past decade, like the Infinity Saga, right? They're trying to set up a new saga. Right. So yeah, I think WandaVision's already carrying a pretty full pack, but yeah, if you want to introduce that, get the Nightmare going, introduce the idea of a little more about how the world of magic works, then I'm in.
Okay, so let me leave you with this. I'm going to read. Everyone loves it on a podcast when you read from a Wikipedia page, right? But let me read this little section from the Nightmare article on Wikipedia. The ultimate Marvel incarnation of Nightmare can shapeshift into different forms based on a victim's memories. He appears in Ultimate Spider-Man, a demon of dreams that plagues Doctor Strange's mind with nightmares. When Spider-Man enters the building, a misconnection led to Nightmare moving to Spider-Man's mind, where the young web-slinger gets plagued by Nightmare's torture. To torment Spider-Man, Nightmare takes the form of Mary Jane Watson, Aunt May, Eddie Brock, Harry Osborn, and the Green Goblin. Doctor Strange eventually entered Spider-Man's mind via a spell and vanquished Nightmare. However, the demon takes Doctor Strange's own father's form. After some effort, Nightmare's main appearance, a half-rotted gray corpse, is revealed as he's defeated. And then he escapes the Sanctorum and possesses Doctor Strange. So if we're talking about a multiverse trilogy of WandaVision, Spider-Man, and Doctor Strange, Nightmare is sort of this overarching villain tormenting and possessing and confusing and confounding these figures with dreams and nightmares and dead characters brought back, etc. That's kind of fun and juicy to think about, right?
It definitely fits the pattern that they've established with the show so far and its themes of grief and loss, for sure.
All right, so we'll see. We'll see how this all turns out. But it's just a fun thing to think. I think Nightmare is much more fun than Mephisto as something to think about. But once again, a drone might just be a drone. And sometimes Quicksilver is just Quicksilver, so you never know. But that is, I mean, this,
These episodes are running long, but there's just so much to talk about with these shows, which, you know, wasn't necessarily obviously going to be the case when it started. So it's really fun. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you wanted to mention?
The little plastic tiger that keeps turning up.
Oh, yeah.
On the show.
Yes, yes.
Not to one more thing. Talk about carrying a heavy pack. This episode is very long. But it's just so conspicuous in the shots. And then there's the Agatha line where she's doing, what was it, jazzercise or something? To calm the babies. And she's like, you can't tame this tiger. I don't know what it means. I think maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it's like oranges in The Godfather. Like, it's just there to catch your eye and be a little bit of a symbolism that doom is near or something's afoot. But definitely notice that tiger. What do you think?
Yeah, it's I absolutely noticed it. It was foregrounded in a couple shots. And I had some questions about it. So we don't have answers, but we just wanted to let you guys know that we're asking questions about this. I think we should read a double entendre into every single thing that Agnes ever says. And I would like to know what she actually sprayed on those babies. But yeah, if you have any tiger thoughts, please email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We got a bunch of great emails. Richard read a few in the first section. I'm sorry we didn't get to any in this section, but I am reading all of your emails. And we will continue to do so. Anthony Bresnikan, where can folks find your great work?
You can find me on vanityfair.com. And always happy for the clicks.
Yeah, you can find Richard there too, as well as my work. And you can find Richard on Twitter at Rylaws. I'm at Joe Wrote This. And we will see you all next week in the 90s.
In the 90s or in the multiverse, wherever you happen to appear.
Sounds good. Bye.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.